You're listening to Dots, Lines, and Destinations, a travel podcast with hosts Stephen Seagraves, Fosma Moon, and Seth Miller.
Hello, and welcome to episode 560 of Dots, Lines, and Destinations. I'm Stephen Seagraves, joined today by Mr. Seth Miller. How you doing?
Limping.
Limping. Broken toe?
Broken toe. Strongly recommend against kicking things in your living room.
What about a broken will to travel? Is that too?
We'll get into that a little later. It was an interesting week, to say the least. And obviously, like, we're recording this on Sunday. The first topic we're going to get into is this, the FAA stuff. But
we'll talk about your travels in the bonus
topic. Nice specifics, yeah, later. But what I wonder is just how much anything of what we're about to say is going to still be accurate, you know, 3 or 4 days from now when this becomes real, when this podcast comes alive.
Yeah, so, I mean, let's just walk through it. So the FAA issued an order on Tuesday of this past week. Was that it was Tuesday, right? Or was it Wednesday? I can't remember. Things are blending together.
Yeah.
But they issued an order, 10% reduction of all flying at a number, 40 hubs or 40 airports.
40 major airports, yeah. It's the top 30 plus a couple plus Teterboro plus cargo. It's sort of like the top 32, Teterboro, and then Ontario is a cargo one. Like some of them, like Anchorage, I think maybe was in the top 40 at 30 anyways, but yeah.
Yeah, I think, and with cargo, it probably fits both.
Yeah. Bills. So it makes some sense to me. And I am, I think, arguably slightly in the minority amongst the talking pundit heads, whatever, in that context. If we don't have staffing to manage the volume of traffic, then we need less traffic.
Yep.
Now, is this the right way to do it? Is this going to be enough? Is it, are we reducing things in the right places at the right times in an efficient way? Almost certainly not. Mm-hmm. And I think one of the big challenges was, like, there was a press conference that was called where the head of the DOT and the head of the FAA made this announcement, and all the airlines and airports were like, hey, and like talking to each other, like, do any of you know what this actually means? Have you heard anything? They didn't have the list of 40 airports ready to publish initially. And I go with this, clearly someone somewhere knew what they were, because relatively, you know, 3 or 4 hours later they leaked, and then the next day it was official. So like it would have made sense to me to have that a little more available. Also, it was a scaled, you know, they've scaled into it. So it was 4% for the first couple of days, then 6, then 8, then 10 by, you know, after a week. And that makes sense, but like no one said that initially. And which air, like they initially said it also is like we're cutting capacity of across the airspace nationwide, not we're reducing takeoffs and landings at key airports. Like, so some strategic blunders there. That said, I still come back to, if there's no air traffic controllers, then you can't have as many planes. And, you know, I got ultimately my flights on Saturday ended up such that I was going to miss connecting JFK on my way to Florida, and I bought a walk-up ticket home back to Boston. But here's hoping travel insurance pays out.
What, I mean, I have a few things we can kind of muddle on here. The reduction in traffic, though, so we're not at the full 10%. Like you said, we're leading up to that full 10%. We're not there yet.
Right.
So we're still seeing some delays, and it seems like it's different airports on different days. Like I think Newark yesterday was like 5.5 hours was the average ground delay. Yeah,
I'm torn on those numbers because, like, I don't know. I feel like they don't always really reflect what's happening.
Okay.
Just because some of those end up canceled and whatever. But yes, this goes back to the which airports are actually understaffed and when, and which, you know, is it airports? Is it en route controllers? And it's all, the answer is all of the above. But like, you know, Newark this morning has a 2-hour line for departure on Sunday morning around 11 a.m. And it's in part because one of the runways is closed. Yeah. Because they're still doing construction. Part of it is staffing. Part of it is weather.
Yeah.
And so like all of those things play into it. That doesn't explain why Houston has a long line.
Mm-hmm. You've got more runways than you know what to do with.
Yeah. And they're only using whatever that one is way out on the far west side. And it's got a line of 30.
Yeah.
So, right. Like, there are some weird, probably the wrong word. There's some challenges. And part of it is they really, like, FAA doesn't know which controllers are or are not going to show up to work on any point. And so they're doing their best, arguably, to reduce demand overall, but you got to reduce it in a way that's actually useful.
Yeah.
And it's hard to say that this is that, but at the end of the day, listen, I don't want planes out there flying if the controllers aren't there. And yesterday, watching planes leaving Boston heading west, they were drawing some real pretty pictures in the sky over upstate New York while they got dispatched and they got out. And then they're like, oh, we actually don't have capacity for you, like, to head further west into the Cleveland center.
Yeah.
And so they're like, I think the Alaska Airlines flight literally did a loop over upstate New York before it was allowed to actually do its transcon.
To more of like a sequencing for the center.
Yeah. It was get them into the air and then they had to sequence them. But normally that sequencing happens before they get off the ground. I don't know if something changed after they were dispatched or what. The other thing that I think is interesting that's been happening a lot this past week is tunneling.
Like what I posted?
Yeah.
Newark, Savannah at 8,000 feet.
Yep. I flew JFK to Raleigh at 6,100.
I mean, it's great.
So, right, this is, and so tunneling means literally tunneling under the normal traffic. There's extras, the ATC calls them escape routes sometimes too. There's basically these extra options available where they can have aircraft fly lower down.
It just takes more fuel.
It takes more fuel. It is slower. It's usually bumpier. I slept like a baby though, so I wouldn't know about any of that. So I was like, wow, you must have great views. That's like of the back of my eyelids.
You're the guy that always has the window shade open. I'm surprised.
I did have the window shade open. I was still sleeping. But I was pretty tired. And they're doing it basically the New York City area to, and I'm interested that you saw Savannah. I had mostly seen the Carolinas and Virginia. Savannah's not that much further than Charleston, I guess. But they're not going too much further than that because at some point the fuel efficiency challenge and just the actual amount of time it takes to get there starts to add up when you're only flying 250 miles an hour instead of 500. But for these sort of shorter 600, 700 mile tops routes, it lets them get an extra few dozen flights in that otherwise they wouldn't have capacity for in the system, right? So they are working the problem from many angles. The one angle they haven't figured out yet is pay the damn controllers.
Yeah, I think there's one piece of this too, like the TRACON piece. I think the overall 10% reduction, the goal is maybe to reduce some of that center TRACON traffic, right? Like the overfly traffic. I don't know if it's that effective at that because United has openly said we're going to cancel non-hub to hub flights and non-international routes. So the hub to hub flights are Newark to San Francisco, Newark to LA, Newark to Denver. That's all flyover traffic,
right?
And requires center. And if you are doing that, then it's not really relieving. And everybody's doing that, right? Delta's going to keep those flights because they're the best yields. Well,
it helps. You need to keep the planes moving to keep the network moving.
Exactly. Like you're carrying a lot of people on those planes. So I don't know it's going to relieve that as much as they hope.
I agree with you there. I think, all of the, a little bit of, every little bit helps.
Yeah.
Somewhere. But yes, it's not going to be a 10%. It's not necessarily reducing Newark by 10% doesn't mean that the overfly stuff gets reduced by 10%.
Yeah.
And so, yes, there is a challenge there, but it should help fill Area C, right? Like,
And
Jacksonville's actually one that's been a big problem lately, because Jacksonville controls the north-south traffic between
Florida. Yeah, that's a problem. Like, if you're going to be circling over Georgia or the Carolinas before you go into Florida, that's not great.
Yeah, and Jacksonville certainly hasn't been as badly understaffed as the New York stuff, just because nothing is, but historically has popped up more than its fair share of staffing issues.
Yeah. The other thing I'll say too is I think this has an maybe it was intended, but it has an unintended consequence, I think too. It's a good consequence. I think it's reduced loads on TSA as well, a tiny bit, because there's fewer people technically flying at a given time. I wonder how that plays out with people being rebooked on other things.
Yeah. Also, in theory, those numbers should go down,
but they haven't.
No. I'm the latest date I can get is the 6th because they don't update it on the weekend. But Thursday, the 6th was 2.7 million passengers screened.
Mm-hmm.
That is up slightly from the 30th, which was a week prior. Now, admittedly, these numbers are before the cuts kicked in. GSA hasn't updated them over the weekend. So grain of salt and all there, but we'll have to see.
Yeah, I mean, someone asked if, you know, traffic has been cut, like if people are not, if they're canceling their plans. I don't know of anyone besides you who's canceled their plans. Like, I have coworkers that are doing transcons next week and the week after, and they're like, yeah, we're going.
And to say that I canceled my plans more than that my plans were canceled might be an interesting choice of words.
You could have kept trying. I mean, you just wanted to be at home at that point, which I get.
I mean, they called me to the counter and said, Mr. Miller, you will not be making it to Florida tonight. We would like rebook you for 2 days from now. And I declined.
All right, let's talk about IAG. I mean, first, I think we should listen. If our listeners have experienced any cancellations or whatever, send us a note. I'd like to hear about your experience.
What I really would love to know is, are you hearing anything from how early in the process are you hearing from airlines that these are happening? Like, part of the challenge here is that the airlines are very last minute being told they have to do this. But like, how far out are you willing to cancel if you're an airline? Because the minute things come back, you want to be able to get back to normal. But I am not at all convinced that like the government is going to reopen and then the next day everybody gets paid and then the next day everybody shows up to work again.
Yeah.
It's going to take time for this to scale back up.
Well, I think the back pay stuff, especially for controllers, I mean, I bet it's probably 30 to 60 days before they get paid the full amount that they're owed.
Yeah. I mean, it's supposed to be fast as written in law, but who the hell knows?
Yeah, I have my doubts. IAG is going to install Starlink.
That is correct. This has been long rumored. Probably a year or so now we've been talking about this at the industry level, but they finally announced it's happening. Install start next year, and this is fleet-wide across all of the IAG subsidiaries or airlines.
Wow.
So, Welling, British Airways, Level, Iberia. Am I missing one?
I think that's
Aer Lingus.
Aer Lingus, yeah.
And those have had, I mean, a wide range of systems over the years, depending on which airline and how and what. But as with all other Starlink deployments, it'll be free for passengers on board. The real question is, how quickly will they actually get it deployed? You know, British Airways announced plans to get, you know, 140 planes on 2KU from Gogo. And that product has now been owned by two other companies, and they still haven't never finished the rollout. So, hopefully this goes faster. And, you know, I think one of the questions that we'll have to see is, what does it look like again as demand grows in congested areas, around hubs and such. But
yeah, I mean, I think BA's lacked Wi-Fi on parts of their fleet for a while, right? And then this will be a stopgap, I guess, between that, where the Wi-Fi has been non-working, I think, for some good point.
So long haul, they had the plan, this 2KU plan, to put it on everything and did a bunch, but then not everything. And then like a year ago, just stopped, which was a pretty good indication that they were going to switch vendors. Sort of like when Alaska Airlines was supposed to be the first to get its regional jets with the new system. And then a year ago, never started that installation, but like, oh no, we're definitely still doing it. With Intelsat now SES. So like, no, you're not. They're like, yo, we definitely are. We definitely are. And then of course, a couple months later, they announced that they're doing Starlink. So, you know, an airline stopping a rollout of a particular vendor is usually a pretty big red flag. But also, like, they did it, Lufthansa Group also did it, like, the short-haul stuff. British Airways has an air-to-ground system on its 320 fleet, and they stopped rolling that out on new ones.
Mm-hmm. Also, good indicator.
Yeah, so, like, the Neos are showing up and didn't have the Wi-Fi installed, which is frustrating as a passenger, especially because when you get a partially fitted subfleet, you never know if your flight's going to have it or not.
Yeah, I think that'd be my request for like IAG too, is if BA is going to install this, put it on the planes that don't have anything first.
Yeah.
Like, rather than yank it out of the plane, you know, because there's parts of the fleet, like you'll just get on a plane, you'll be like, oh, I expected to have Wi-Fi. Nope, no Wi-Fi.
And it's like random chunks of their 787s do and don't.
Yeah, exactly.
Interestingly, the 787 is one of the hardest to install on because Boeing won't let you touch the fuselage.
Oh, that's right. We talked about this a few episodes back.
Like, yeah, we have RAM. Or with Virgin. Sorry, with Virgin. And their special mount, you know, whatever. Now that they have it, Boeing has this thing ready to go. It basically becomes a matter of timing. And we'll see when Boeing first announced that they had the solution coming out, which was back in April this year, there was debate and confusion amongst Boeing's different groups within Boeing and some of the partners of whether third parties would be allowed to sort of license the install process from Boeing, or if Boeing Global Services had to perform it. And if it's the latter, what level of throughput can Boeing produce? How much staff do they have available, and how many planes can they process at a time? You know, if you think about United's install on its regional fleet of these very similar hardware, United's basically doing 15 a month, I think, is the plan.
Yep.
For their 737-800s, they said it's going to be 15 a month, which still takes over a year to get through all of them because it's such a big fleet. But that's super fast. And that's one airline, and that's separate from the regional jets, which are at a similar pace, and. And if you're Boeing and you've got all these airlines coming to you now saying all of our 787s need to be retrofit and we need it all done by the end of 2026, Boeing doesn't have that does Boeing have that throughput? I don't know. I would guess the answer is no.
Yeah, I mean, where are they even doing this? Is it Everett? Is it Boeing?
I don't know.
I mean, because that's a constraint right there. Like, if the Boeing field, you got to have someone to park the plane.
And a lot of those parking places are taken up by not yet delivered.
Yeah, and if it's Moses Lake, okay, it's great. But do you have people out there that know how to do this in Moses Lake? Maybe.
Yeah, and you know, could they bring it? Boeing Global Services, they bring a group of people to London and say, okay, British Airways, let's go. And like,
we'll do them all.
Our staff, or not, they'll bring them to Wales or CWL. Where's the maintenance base?
Yep.
We'll bring our people to your maintenance base and use your facility. Like, I don't know how they're doing it, but and they may end up letting the airlines do it themselves. But there is some question about how that's all going to play out.
Yeah, yeah. Delta's A330s are getting an update. But they need, this is the classics, the 200s and the 300s.
Correct. This is another fun, this has been talked about for a while, rumored. Delta One mini suites in the same numbers as today. The 300 gets an extra row of premium economy.
Okay.
And gets more Comfort Plus, which is their extra legroom product, while losing a row of regular economy. The bit about this came out in a filing with the FAA or DOT asking for permission to put the mini suite doors in the cabin, because technically those aren't allowed per the base regulations. They filed it on Halloween. It got published on Wednesday the 5th or whatever. And when I asked about it, Delta declined to comment. So it's happening, but Delta's not talking about it yet, which is interesting. They'd say they were fitting all of them, which is interesting. But we also know, I think that is at this point a recognition that the 75s and 76s are definitely going away in the next few years. And there's just not enough aircraft available on the market to backfill in this space. And so you've got to keep the 330s around longer.
So does this make the 330 family then look pretty similar to the 330 Neos? Like, I haven't looked at the seat maps, but is it space-wise, is it pretty close?
It'll be similar. I think the 900 is the same size as the 300. It's just got the new engines, right? So,
and the 330 Neos, they only have 29 J seats in them.
Yeah, so the new ones, or the refreshed 330 CEOs, are going to be, they're keeping the 34J.
Okay.
So that is an interesting bit, but I'm pulling up the list now. So both the 200 and 300 will be fitted with 34 mini suite business class seats, with the privacy door. The 200 gets three rows of premium selected 232, okay, which is the same as what it has today. And today it has 168 in coach, and that will drop to 166. And one of the regular rows becomes Comfort Plus, basically, but they lose two seats on board somehow.
Interesting.
Yeah, the 300 goes from 21 to 28 in premium economy, which we've talked about, you know, far too much. The industry clearly going towards a more premium layout. And then 56 Comfort Plus and 163 regular economy, which is 219 seats compared to a 227, a 24-203 config today. So going from 24 to 56 Comfort Plus, that's what, three rows to seven? That's a whole bunch of extra Comfort Plus.
Yeah, it's a lot.
They're not losing that many seats considering they're adding the Comfort Plus or the Delta Premium Select, Premium Economy. Too many names. What I am interested in some ways is, and we talked about this last week, American is not doing those extra legroom seats, but Delta and United are on this board layout.
So American's putting in the Premium Economy, but they're not putting in the extra legroom regular economy seats when they do this.
Basically, American is doing it at their exit rows, their bulkhead rows. They're calling those premium. Delta and United have done it for multiple rows in those cabins.
Yeah. I'm looking at Delta's layouts. Some of their seat maps, they're the most befuddling I think I've ever seen. Like, they have a mid-cabin galley, and they have...
On which?
On the 330-200s. Okay. They have a mid-cabin galley for J. I'm guessing it serves the rear J cabin and the front J cabin. Then they have a front galley, and then the only two bathrooms are in the front. Like, that feels like chaos. And then there's only mid-cabin labs for the rear cabins.
Yeah.
Though, it's weird. It's very strange. Maybe they found that it works. I don't know.
Yeah.
Anyway, I'm getting off topic.
On this show, never.
MD-11. So we haven't talked about the crash at all, and we probably should, but I think the big story that comes out of the Louisville UPS crash is the MD-11s from FedEx and UPS are all grounded right now.
And I'm assuming Western Global also, but they only have like three of them, so.
Yep. So the crash happened at Louisville Airport, just to the, I guess, the southeast. It's the south side of the airport. And all three pilots on board were killed. And then 12 people, I think, is the number now on the ground.
Yeah, a bunch.
And it hit like the worst things. And these are things that are always around airports. It hit like a tire recycling facility, like a oil facility, and a trucking company. So all flammable, very flammable things. So it's awful. And I think we can tell from the video that the one engine was missing at takeoff and was found at the airport after the crash. So it's not good.
Not good at all. Over the weekend, after a day or two, the UPS and then FedEx shortly thereafter agreed to voluntarily ground their planes in line with recommendations from the aircraft manufacturer, which basically is Boeing saying, hey, until we know what's actually happening here, how about not so much?
Yeah.
And remember, Boeing bought McDonnell Douglas, so they're technically Boeing aircraft now, but they were built as McDonnell Douglas. I haven't gone back and checked when did any MD-11s get built post-merger, or is that only the 80s?
I think only the MD-80s, but I'm not sure.
And I just don't remember the timings on it, but either way.
Yeah.
Yeah, these are McDonnell Douglas airplanes, but now owned by Boeing. And then the following day, the FAA did put out an emergency airworthiness directive saying these planes are grounded until they have been inspected per metrics that don't exist yet, basically.
Yeah.
Which is fine, but they have to now... have to come up with what that plan is going to be.
Yeah. It's always interesting to me to what kind of hyperbole comes out. And I was expecting the hyperbole after this to be, oh, you know, the air is unsafe, like because we don't have controllers. That's kind of the narrative I was waiting for.
Yeah.
But that wasn't the narrative that came out. It was more, this is a really old plane. Why are we still flying it? And it's like, there are planes that you fly on as a passenger that are probably older than you think. So,
yeah,
it's not that old. It was how old was it? 40 years, maybe 35.
Yeah, it's pretty old, Stephen.
That's pretty old. Yeah. I'm old then, so.
Yeah.
We'll see what they find. I have a lot of concerns that the plane was in maintenance until this flight that it took, basically. So it flew from San Antonio to Louisville after a bunch of maintenance work done in San Antonio. And then it apparently, or the rumor is, it took a 2-hour delay leaving Louisville because of a mechanical problem, and then it took off. So we'll see what comes of that. And then more depressing Boeing news. They entered a settlement agreement with... I'll let you explain it.
Yeah, so this is further fallout from the MAX crashes. They had a non-prosecution agreement and a payment that they had arranged, and then after the door plug blowout with Alaska Airlines, the feds reopened that and were like, hey, maybe you haven't actually figured your shit out, and we are going to punish you for killing people with your airplanes. And ultimately, they basically paid an extra $1 billion and get to not be criminally prosecuted. I am not a fan of that, but, you know, and I I think my favorite was the response online was, well, if we did that, then we wouldn't have Boeing Defense anymore because the government can't buy from a convicted felon. And so they wouldn't be able to buy any parts from Boeing anymore. And then our whole defense industry would collapse. And like, that may be, but that's still not a good enough reason to let them get away with murder to me. I don't know.
Where's the Jerry Seinfeld popcorn gif? That's a shame.
Right, right. I understand it's a complex world out there and lots of things are interconnected. I still think that no one personally being held responsible for what were terrible decisions made. And I like,
it's hard to argue against that.
At this point, we know pretty clearly that people purposefully made decisions and withheld information and tried to hide things about how these planes work. And they did it to protect costs and save money and whatnot. And people died as a result. And no, you know, I'd like to believe that some people, at least on their conscience, are suffering for that. But even there, I'm not so sure. And that's the best we're going to get out of it.
Yep. Just the uplifting news I needed for the weekend. Thanks.
Yay, I'm here to help.
Yep. All right. Well, is there anything else?
No, I was going to say welcome to a couple of our newer Patreon supporters, Bert and Jamie, who signed up recently. Thanks for joining the party.
Yeah, thank you. And for the bonus topics this week, we're going to talk a little bit about Lufthansa first class lounges and terminals and a partnership with Sixt, AirAsia and Bahrain, Seth's travel woes, and some credit card changes that might be coming here soon. So we'll talk about that in the bonus topics. To our regular listeners, thank you very much for listening and enjoying the show. We appreciate it, and we will talk to you next time. Happy travels.
Take care.